WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America's two most colorful spin doctors are now husband and wife. After working against each other in the 92 presidential campaign, James Carville and Mary Madeline not only got married, they collaborated on a joint memoir that has just been published called All's Fair, Love, War, and Running for President. Carville and Madeline started seeing each other shortly before he became chief strategist for the Clinton-Gore campaign and she became deputy campaign manager for President Bush. In fact, Madeline did her best to keep their relationship a secret until she secured her position in the campaign. She was afraid that she'd never get a high-placed position if she was regarded as consorting with the enemy. Earlier today, I asked Carville and Madeline if they thought journalists were more aware of and skeptical of spinning than they were in the 88 campaign, and if that made spinning more difficult.
I don't think it's different at all. I've been now involved in the last three presidential campaigns and campaigns before then, and we are not the rules makers. We are the games players. If the press tells us that, as they used to 30 years ago, there were a 42-second soundbite, we would comply with that. Today, there's a 7-second soundbite, so we create 7-second soundbites. We have to work within the parameters that the media sets. The sum of what might have changed by degrees is that some of our quotes, comments, are more, let's say, colorful, to be charitable. And why is that? Because you can't break through. The press will not, if the president or the candidate's going to be giving the same speech over and over as he has to do to get his message out on the economy or whatever it is, and they won't cover it anymore. So part of our job is figuring out different ways to say the same thing and get the message out.
This kind of reminds me of in Casablanca when they said they were shocked that there was gambling going on. I mean, you know, public radio readers, listeners, let me share something with you. You may be shocked to know that when we work in campaigns, we fight as hard as we can to put our candidate in the most favorable light. Now, there's not
shocked.
And so what happens here is we have the media, whose excesses have now almost reached a point of almost being ridiculous, blaming, quote, spin doctors. Well, for every quote that we have in a paper, a reporter called us and asked us to give one. And if you don't want to hear from campaign people or campaign spokespeople, call somebody else.
Mary Madeline, Republican campaign, especially during one night at the convention, had an emphasis on family values, which you say was never really planned, that the family values emphasis was never really a pre-planned part of the campaign. Nevertheless, I find it really ironic that here you are directing the campaign. You're a very independent woman, divorced, living in sin part-time with James. A kind of a walking contradiction in a way of the family values platform and the image of what a woman should be that some of the Republicans were holding up. And I wonder what you made of that.
I'm not really understanding the nature of this question. I mean, there are Republicans, there are Democrats, there are independents, there are non-voters who have just have their own view of how they want to run their lives. I don't check in on what people are thinking about before I run my life, which, by the way, I wasn't living in sin with James Carville before we got married. We never lived together.
Oh, you never lived together?
And I don't think getting a divorce in this day and age is any kind of something that one has to feel belies some sort of affection or approval of family values. What I said in the campaign was that to the extent that the media said that family values was a centerpiece of our strategy was wrong. And what I said critically of the campaign was that to the extent we ever talked about family, we never were able to describe how that translated into policy. And that our inability to define what family's policy meant left a vacuum to be filled by what our definition wasn't, which largely was articulated by, at least in the media's eyes, by Pat Buchanan at the convention, which is not, I don't think, George Bush's view.
Well, did you try to... I'm sorry, James, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I mean, my own view is I think the whole thing was good for us, and it's ultimately stupid for anybody to think that, you know, Pat Buchanan or Pat Robinson is gonna, you know, by giving speeches. I mean, like I said in the book, you know, you can see somebody that, you know, that's gay saying, gee, I just got a speech from Pat Robinson and I think I'm gonna change tomorrow. I mean, it's, you know, just that
it was pretty gratuitous.
Yeah. But
well, what's your point?
My point is just I think the Republican convention actually ended up hurting the Republicans more than it helped them. I think that any time that government gets into this sort of thing about preaching about people, it tends to be more embarrassing than helpful in the long run. I mean, certainly in the short term, there's a political gain to be gotten by this, but I think in the long term, it ends up hurting more than helping.
And this from a guy whose president came back from Martha's Vineyard saying he had to change strategies and he was going to start talking about values. This from a guy whose president was quoting Dan Quayle. I concede in the book that how the press played out the Buchanan speech did not help the campaign. I also say there were 128 speeches. In addition to that, not the least of which were President Bush's, Phil Graham's, Lynn Martin's, Jack Kemp's, which didn't get nearly as much play. Was it a bad campaign event? Yes. Is it sort of hypocritical for you to sit here and say that the government shouldn't be preachy when your president has had his fair share of preachiness in the past 2 years? I think is gratuitous.
Well, again, what I mean, be very clear. I mean, I think the president should talk about values, but when you sit up there and you say that we're in a religious war here, when you have sort of people like Pat Robinson there, when you have people like Jerry Falwell who are front and center in the convention, I think that's sending the very narrow message to the American people. But I think the president ought to, you know, quote, talk about values.
You know, in watching you both during the campaign, I felt that in some ways you were both very similar. In other ways, you were incredibly different. Similar in the sense that you both seemed very refreshing, very individualistic, very funny, you know, very quotable, but different in the sense of the kind of campaigns you were running. And let me explain what I mean here. I mean, James Carville, your emphasis on the campaign seemed to be, let's keep this very focused on the economy and healthcare and not allow the press to get us off into tangents. And whatever we're asked, we're going to refocus on what we think is the most important political message here. And Mary Madeline, a lot of times in the Republican campaign, you were giving very flamboyant quotes that were more about personality than about issues, things like calling the Clintons Clintonistas, sniveling liberal Democrats. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, let me say something.
Go ahead.
In as we are finding out now, sometimes it's different when you're the incumbent and you're the challenger. Mm-hmm. And I think what Mary was trying to do, I'm explain it as opposed to, like, sometimes to be heard in a campaign, you try to put things out, and until you do things in a sort of a controversial way, mm-hmm. it becomes very difficult for them to be heard. And I think that what she was doing is she was fighting her heart out for her candidate. And I think that clearly what happened was is that she was trying to do these things and it never got much attention. And what happens is that you have a situation where the media is not interested in something until it becomes controversial. And you have to be controversial to get your message out. It's kind of, and then when you become controversial to get your message out, you become creative. I mean, it's kind of you become criticized. That's one of these kind of vicious cycles here.
What was not relayed about how I came to write sniveling hypocritical Democrats is that fact that was part of a fax program where we sent out a fax a day, talking about something in Clinton's record that we thought he had misrepresented or something he said misrepresenting our record, proceeding and started sometime in July. From January 7th until July, every single day we gave to the press a so-called white paper, an erudite description of it, George Bush on this policy or something, and they never, ever, ever in 7 months used any of them. When you stress, that's, as I said, somewhere along the line, then when you dress these things up, then they tend to, I didn't particularly want them to do the sniveling hypocritical Democrats, but that got them to read on. And many of those facts is the substance of what we were trying to get out, because they had fancy headlines or gripping or retching or sophomoric, whatever, juvenile headlines, caused the media to read on to the substance of the press release and many of the then observed flip-flops in the Clinton record or statements were subsequently reported because of that. And I don't make any apologies for it. And I think the suggestion you were trying to suggest that mine was a more personal and ad hominem attack, and they really weren't. If you look at what they were, the substance of them had to do with Clinton's record and qualifications for president. And I am in no way apologetic for the way I work on campaigns.
You know what I think everybody really wants to know? When you're running a campaign, how much are the issues that you determine through polls or whatever would be effective issues for your candidate to talk about, and how much of it is really what the candidate stands for and what they told you they stand for and they want the campaign to be about?
A candidate stands for 50 things, 100 things. Who knows how many things? And somebody runs for president, I mean, you know, George Bush probably been in public office of, you know, supposedly the best resume of anybody since World War II. Bill Clinton had been governor of a state for 12 years and given a gazillion speeches. I mean, they stand for so many things. Again, so much of what a good campaign tries to do is to sort of say, we have to pick two or three of the things that we want to articulate. And you can't, there's no way that you can communicate 50 or 100 things to the American people. It is impossible to do. No one has ever been able to do it. No one will ever be able to do it. So, as I say in the book, so much of our time is spent actually emptying full vessels as opposed to filling up empty vessels.
My guests are James Carville and Mary Madeline. They've collaborated on a new book called All's Fair, Love, War, and Running for President. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mary Madeline and James Carville. In comparing both your strategies, I'd like you to both talk about when it became clear that there was a Bill Clinton letter, the letter you describe as the thank you for helping me get out of the draft letter. How did you both see that as an opportunity?
Well, I mean, clearly, when I saw it, my first reaction was, we got to publish this in a newspaper.
Yeah, now why did you think like it would be better for you to actually go with it yourself?
Okay, well, I mean, because at that time, if you go back, and we were, that weekend, we were in sort of free fall.
Mm-hmm.
It was the worst weekend we'd had a campaign. And a lot of it was because of a story about a draft that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was on a Thursday before that, by Jeff Birnbaum. So when this came out, again, it your instinct has got to be, the story is there, okay? The draft story is there. It's better to get in front of it, and it's better to use the letter to explain yourself. I thought the letter was a good thing because it was, A, intelligently written, and it sort of explained what was going on in a then 22-year-old's mind.
So what was the best way to get it out?
Well, we talked about it. We went on Nightline. We took out a full-page ad in the Manchester paper. We went on national TV. I mean, once the decision is made to get it out, getting it out is not that hard. We had a press conference with a bazillion people in an airplane hangar. I mean, we were on Nightline, and Ted Koppel read the entire letter on Nightline. We took out full-page ads in newspapers. We talked about it. We spun it, I guess you could say.
Now, Mary Madeline, did you see that letter as an opportunity for the Republicans?
Again, this incident occurred during the New Hampshire primary where, as we say in the business, never interfere with your enemy when he's in the process of destroying himself. We thought that the other Democrats would have a field day with it, and in fact they did. What we subsequently saw as an opportunity in the whole draft issue was the then governor's, throughout as many campaigns as governor in Arkansas, had about just as many different stories of his draft status and his experience with all of that, and we thought of it as yet another example of inconsistencies in his, which doesn't matter if he's describing inconsistencies in his own life, but we saw that as something that was his policy formulation was replete with. But that was something that people could understand better than they could understand the tos and fros of policy flip flops.
Now, James Carville, you're working on at least two campaigns now, I think, Harris Warford.
And Zell Miller.
And Zell Miller, yeah. And Mary Madeline, I believe you're not working on campaigns now, but I know you have your show on CNBC and you're a commentator on the Today Show. I guess, Mary, I'm wondering why you're not working on campaigns now.
Well, I'm campaigning for a number of candidates, as many as I can squeeze in just about every week, and I'll be on a campaign trip doing fundraisers and speaking on behalf of candidates. Why I'm not working on a campaign is because it's a full-time job, and I needed to have a job after the campaign, and there weren't any campaigns then, and the first job that I got was this, my TV job. And the other thing is, we don't want to. I never, if you notice in the book, I've, for the last 14 years have worked on national politics. I have not worked in a state race since 1980. I don't go to states and live in the states. And that's what these 1994 races are about. So it would be kind of difficult in a brand new marriage for both of us to be living in different states, and not something we chose to do.
Yeah, I mean, so, I don't know where we're going with this, but and I'm working on these campaigns. I can no longer, now that I'm, to do the way that Mary and I did campaigns, you have to throw your whole self in it. This is not something that you show up to for, you know, 8, 9, 10 hours a day. And, you know, she goes and she does fundraisers. She stays involved. She has a show. I mean, we're doing a book and everything else. I mean, I wish I was in a position. But some of the best times in my life were when I could go in and working for Governor Miller in 1990, or Senator Wofford in 1991, where I could actually move into the headquarters. I could give my whole self to it. Well, B, I have other responsibilities. I'm married now. And furthermore, I've become, as I've said any number of times before, I've become more of a character than a consultant. And just my presence in a campaign now becomes more disruptive than it is helpful.
It's more disruptive?
Sure. Can be very disruptive.
How so?
Well, people say, well, ask Carville. So everything the candidate says, and people on there say, well, Carville told him to say that. You know, I mean, because I've become, and largely at my own help in making, I've become, you know, I've written a book on a presidential race. So it used to be that I could walk in and at 6 o'clock in the morning, I would get in a campaign. I would look at the clips. I'd say, you know what I mean? Make assignments. Who we're going to do? What was our thing today? Do a yellow pad out and do a to-do list and do all the kinds of things that good campaign managers would do. I would go out sometimes and see how the candidate was doing on the road and that type of stuff. But now, but people have started asking me questions about the book, and I understand that. I'm just saying, my presence in a campaign is different than it used to be.
Well, this isn't all negative. We're making it sound negative.
Yeah, I'm not mad about it.
I've been able to, thank goodness, knock on wood, raise some goodly amounts of money for candidates, which they desperately need. I mean, I can't go work, as James says, 80 hours a week, but I can go raise some money for them, which they need as much as they need people telling them.
I want to be clear. I'm not whining about this. The other thing is, I have a wife. I want to spend time with my wife. I don't want to move. I'm 50 years old. I mean, I don't want to go live in an apartment by myself and anywhere now for 2 or 3 months as I used to do. I mean, we've been very fortunate in this. I mean, so please don't think that we're complaining about this. It's just a fact of life.
You know what's hard for a lot of people to figure out, and I wouldn't ask this except that it's in part the subject of your book, is if you're both so diametrically opposed politically, it must be hard to have a relationship where you're not disagreeing all the time.
Well, no, you just don't talk about politics. It presumes that people
have... politics is at the center of your lives.
Well, listen, we still work. I mean, I still hang out with all my Republican friends, and it takes a lot to get ready to go in and do these campaigns. I do a different speech for each campaign. I do a show every night in which I am not a talk show host or journalist. I'm a partisan. I always take the partisan point of view, the point of that being that all day long I'm in my conservative world talking to my conservative friends and doing all the politics I want to do. When I come home, we do so many other things that we have in common. We run, we read, we love to read, we love to eat. We just don't need to do politics 24 hours a day. And if we know it's going to be a cause of consternation in our relationship, which we have proved repeatedly, we don't talk about it. We just avoid those areas that are going to cause discomfort to our relationship.
Jeez, I mean, if anything, I think it's helped that I wouldn't want to go home, assume that I was married to someone who I was politically compatible with. And all that person wanted to talk about was politics. I mean, you know, 14 hours a day, anything is enough.
The thing is, it's a worldview, politics. It's everything from, it's what you believe about culture.
We don't disagree, but no,
it's not.
No, but we don't. There's plenty of issues that we agree on.
We really agree on.
But why? But it's just not. All I can say is we're very, very fortunate people. We had, like I said, we had a chance to do something that, Mary's been able to work in presidential campaigns twice. We have very fortunate to be able to have written this book, and we're very fortunate in a lot of ways. And I think one of the things that actually what makes us fortunate is that we just, because we, if we get into sort of policy arguments about politics, we tend to we tend to end up in an argument. We just discussed the process of politics. We'll see this morning we saw the vice president on TV talking about Haiti, and we were sort of commenting about
his presentation, his presence.
We could have very easily gotten into an argument about Haiti, but we could make the observation about it. We see some campaign do something. We'll say, well, that was smart what that person did or what this person didn't do. Or what do you think about that? I mean, I get this question a lot.
Let me interrupt if I can, going back to the worldview question, because implicit in that question is we must be hypocrites about our beliefs, otherwise, you know, otherwise we'd be fighting all the time. The truth of the matter is we very much disagree on economic policy. We have a very different view of the role of government in Americans' lives. But having said that, we are both cultural Catholics. We both come from loving families. We both believe that in public service, and we just think that, and we both believe in America, not to be goo-goo about this, in a better America. We just think there's different ways of getting there. That doesn't make us at odds with our worldview. Our worldview starts with the family, and it goes out from there, and we're both very blessed to have beautiful, loving families that we get to talk to every day and visit with. And one of the wonderful side effects of having some little financial security now for the first time in our lives is that we get to bring our families up here and see them more than we used to. So that's what our worldview is. I mean, we really don't sit around and talk about choice versus life, you know, at the breakfast table. That's not how we get up in the morning.
It hasn't been. I mean, if we talk about it. We tend to, in the end, the conversation ends up into an argument, but we talk about it less and less because, frankly, we don't like to argue. if anybody that's married will tell you, it's just no fun arguing, and it's no fun going through the 15 minutes of, 2 hours it takes to get over the argument. So it's just like a stick your hand in a fire for your child, as my uncle used to say. Well, don't tell him no, just let him stick it in there, and he burn it enough, he'll quit doing it.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It was fun.
Bye-bye.
Mary Madeline and James Carville are co-authors of a new memoir called All's Fair, Love, War, and Running for President. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.